unemployment rate falls to 9.4%, the lowest level in more than a year.
But job growth in this country is still pretty meager.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, January 7th, 2011. Coming up, as lawmakers re-debate the nation's new health care law, states are starting to implement it. Also, the president revamps his economic team and an alarming blog about wake-up alarms.
But first, the nation's unemployment rate fell by nearly 0.5% in December. Meanwhile, the Labor Department this morning told us businesses and the government only added 103,000 jobs for the month. Let's get some analysis this morning from Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch. She's with us on Fridays, as always, from New York. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Explain to us a little bit about this report, because I see a near 0.5% drop in unemployment, down to 9.4%. Wow, that sounds pretty cool, right? But then we have the disappointing job creation numbers. 100,000, just a little more than that. Doesn't quite jibe, does it?
No, but it makes sense because they're based on two separate surveys, which is why they often diverge. I think the more important number is the job creation number. You know, 104,000 is a disappointment. We need to see over 200,000 jobs a month to put some of these 14.5 million people back to work.
I was thinking it was going to be a better report than it was, given the more optimistic numbers we got earlier in the week.
Remember? Well, you know, yeah, Challenger Gray and Christmas said layoffs are tapering off, and obviously they are. ADP said that they had 297,000 private sector jobs. You know what? That's not been a very reliable predictor of government numbers. And the way they account for seasonal adjustments can often distort the numbers. So I think a lot of people have discounted the ADP number. It's good for a headline, but it doesn't often jibe.
So we get that headline earlier in the week, and then we get today's official, you know, this quote-unquote official report from the Labor Department, and people are a little disappointed.
Right. And I think the most important takeaway here is we still need to see more, you know, something like 150,000, 200,000 jobs to move forward in the jobs market.
Jill Schlesinger at CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Let's get another take now on today's big employment report. Hugh Johnson heads up his own advisory firm in Albany, New York, and he's with us now. Hi, Hugh.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So let's get your reaction first to these numbers.
Disappointing. The 103,000 jobs added to payrolls was well below both my expectations and I would say just about everybody's expectations. Going into the number, we'd been expecting about 150,000 jobs would be added to payrolls. And frankly, with some of the recent economic numbers that we've seen, we're kind of hoping that 200,000 would be added to payrolls. So 103,000 added to payrolls in December was very anemic and very disappointing.
And what about this 9.4% unemployment rate? That's a drop.
Yeah, that's a drop. And at first blush, that kind of looks like a really good number, but you have to look very carefully at it. The reason that you had the decline in the unemployment rate was a very sharp decline, an unexpected decline, in the size of the labor force. And the reason the labor force declined so sharply is if you look at the numbers, you see that the number of workers that became very discouraged and simply dropped out of the labor force, stopped looking for jobs, dropped out of the labor force, was very substantial. So what looks like a good number, a decline from 9.8 to 9.4%, when you look at it a little more closely, is not such a good number and is a little bit disappointing also. Again, both of these together suggest that maybe the economy is expanding, but it's expanding at an extraordinarily anemic pace.
All right. Hugh Johnson of Hugh Johnson Advisors joining us from Albany. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Debate could start today in the House of Representatives on a bill to repeal the nation's new health care law. Now, that effort comes just as the Congressional Budget Office released an estimate that says doing away with that law would add $230 billion to the deficit within the next decade and result in 32 million fewer people having health insurance. Republicans dispute those numbers. Despite all the talk in Washington, state governors are moving ahead to implement the law, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The repeal rhetoric was flying on Capitol Hill yesterday. New House Speaker John Boehner.
I think it's pretty clear to the American people that the best health care system in the world is going to go down the drain if we don't act.
But even if the House repeals the health care law, the Senate is unlikely to follow suit, and President Obama is standing by with his veto pen. So states are getting down to the business of implementing the law. Even Republican governors who campaigned against the health care overhaul are now applying for federal grants to put it into effect. Leighton Koo teaches health policy at George Washington University. He says they're discovering the difference between campaigning and governing.
It's one thing for politicians to say, this is what how I'd like to see things changed, but that is different than recognizing this is what I have to do right now under the existing law.
The health care law gives the states lots of responsibilities, like setting up exchanges where consumers can buy health insurance. And if the states don't implement the law, the feds will do it for them. Not an appealing prospect for independent-minded governors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Another day, another new White House advisor. President Obama today is expected to announce a new head of the National Economic Council. This person would replace Larry Summers. And the name that's being floated out there is Gene Sperling. If that rings a bell, it's because he's an alum of the Clinton administration and brings some credibility from Wall Street. Is this a new White House overture to big business? From Washington, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Obamanomics, Clintonomics. See any similarities? Gene Sperling already ran the Economic Council under the previous Democratic president and is coming back for round two. Former Clinton Commerce Secretary William Daley is the brand new chief of staff at the White House. But before returning to Washington, both men took stints on Wall Street, and the financial sector could use some wooing from the administration, thinks Norm Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute.
Financial institutions owe their very existence in many ways to what Obama has done. But they've been turned off by the rhetoric and by a couple of the policy proposals.
Like the Clinton White House, the Obama administration took a beating in the midterms, and now it hopes to replicate the Democratic White House political recovery from the mid-90s, with similar advisors and perhaps a similar brightening economy. Many economists think the employment situation has bottomed out and is turning up. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the 7th day of January, 2011. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? In China, a new report says the annual death toll from smoking could triple over the next two decades. One of the biggest obstacles in preventing those deaths? Turns out it's the Chinese government. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The report comes just a couple of days before a World Health Organization deadline China agreed to that aims to ban smoking in all indoor public spaces, workplaces, and public transportation by this Sunday. But as of Friday at my favorite noodle shop in Shanghai, most of my fellow patrons were puffing away, making the place look like a sauna, and doing a number on my lungs. China has obviously fallen short with the smoking ban, which was supposed to outlaw cigarette advertising, too. Health advocates say the $90 billion tobacco industry is too lucrative for China's state-owned enterprises for Beijing to do anything to solve the problem. Dr. Sarah England of the World Health Organization is trying to convince Beijing otherwise.
The tax revenue from tobacco is only half the economic argument. There's also the other side of the coin, which is the productivity impact, the medical costs.
But with the median price of a pack of cigarettes in China at 76 cents, when it comes to a ban, few here are holding their breath, unless they're non-smokers in a room full of smoke. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Like most of Europe, Romania faces major budget cuts and a tough economic environment. The government plans to make up some of the budget shortfalls by bringing in higher and newer kinds of taxes. The Romanian president has even proposed including the profession of witchcraft in that country's new tax code. And that's brewed a whole lot of controversy there. Witches from all corners of Romania have gathered to curse the government for the idea. The BBC's Central European correspondent Rob Cameron is with us to talk about it. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning to you.
So what exactly did the witches do to wreak their vengeance on the politicians in Romania?
Well, what they did was they gathered on the shore of the Danube River and they hurled mandrake, which is a poisonous herb whose root can resemble a human being, into the river, all the while uttering dark incantations. Mm. And they're so angry because under this new law, they'll have to pay 16% tax plus social security contributions on their earnings. That's along with fortune tellers and, bizarrely, driving instructors, although they weren't at the protest.
Is this a universal reaction, Rob? I mean, are all the witches across Romania reacting like this?
Well, not all of them, no. Some say that being completely legal, taxpayers, gives them the recognition they've long deserved and so craved. Mihela Mincea is one young witch who actually wants to pay tax.
From my point of view, this law adopted now is very good, and I'm very happy because the Romanian government considered that our magic skills, which are recognized and accepted worldwide, are now authorized in Romania too.
So they have credibility, in other words. Is this a big deal? I mean, how popular is witchcraft in Romania, Rob?
Well, this is, of course, the country that gave us Dracula. Certainly some older people, I think, out in the villages in Transylvania do believe in the power of curses. Even the president, it is said, sometimes wears purple to ward off evil spirits.
The BBC's Rob Cameron in Prague. Rob, thank you.
You're very welcome.
The French are the champions of the world. That's according to a magazine headline this week in France. Unfortunately, they're the champions because France just came in first place in a ranking of the most pessimistic countries. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard joins me now from London, just across the English Channel from France, with more on this. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Can you actually see the coast of France from where you are right now?
I could do better than that. I can see a French woman. My wife is French.
So there you go.
I better be careful what I say.
Tell us then, in your quietest whisper, why the French are so depressed.
Well, crise de foi is the obvious French explanation. This is that uniquely French digestive malady brought on by too much rich food. No, this was a survey about the economic outlook of 53 countries. The French came out as the most worried about the future, which must have something to do with unemployment there, which is 9 or 10%, and deficit cutting. I mean, the French are particularly attached to government spending, and government spending is going to be cut in the year ahead, and that's clearly making the French gloomy.
And government spending could be cut right here in the United States, Stephen. How do we rank on this ranking of the most pessimistic countries?
Much better than the French. In fact, the US was more or less in the middle as far as optimism and pessimism is concerned. The Brits and, perhaps unsurprisingly, Icelanders were more pessimistic than Americans.
And quickly, who are the optimists?
Vietnam was the most optimistic, which tells you something about national mood. The bleaker your past, it seems, the rosier your hopes for the future.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks so much.
Okay, Jeremy.
Steve, there are a lot of people who say they can't live without their cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's a case where that's actually true. Gunshots were fired at a nightclub fight in Atlanta early yesterday morning. Mm. A valet who was working at the club was hit, but the bullet was stopped by the cell phone that he had in his breast pocket.
Wow.
I know. The valet, whose name is John Garber, is fine. The cell phone is no longer working.
It is not.
It's not fine at all. And Garber says his boss owes him a new phone. I'd say so. You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, January 7th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. As the new year rang in, California became the first state in the nation to force big restaurant chains to post calorie information inside their stores and on their menu boards. Now, there's a similar law in New York City that took effect last April. Will the new law here in California make for healthier food choices? Brian Elbel is assistant professor of medicine and health policy at New York University. He's with us right now to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
How does posting calories affect the way people eat out and the foods they choose?
It doesn't appear to have a large impact on the foods that people are choosing. That said, I think once it gets phased in towards a larger population, we might be seeing a larger effect.
Do people really pay attention to all this anyway? Are they looking at this stuff?
Some people clearly are, and there's clearly a subset of the population that really wants this information and likely is using it, but it's not necessarily everyone. Many people are going in, they're ordering what they always order, and they're moving on. But as these calorie labeling regulations get phased in across the country, with California happening now, you might see this information become a little more actualized in people's minds and be used in a larger way.
You know, Brian, do attitudes change depending upon where we're talking about here? So, I mean, say I'm in a fancy restaurant, I'm having a nice dinner. I don't think I'm so concerned about how many calories my, shrimp and grits will have, right?
So it's very possible, and we're just starting to look at these non-fast food places. That said, if you're going into a place where you thought those shrimp and grits were healthy, and you realize that they're not, then you might sort of change your mind in a little different way. So it's really kind of about how the actual calories meet your expectations for how many calories there should be in that meal.
Posting these calorie counts has been touted as a way to make people stay slim, of course, make inroads on obesity. Is there truth in that?
It's possible that these labels, as they get rolled out, are going to have some influence on healthy eating. They're not going to be enough. I think we're going to need other policies and regulations and movement on the business side to really have a larger scale influence on obesity. So we're going to need to look at things like pricing and advertising and availability of foods in certain communities.
Brian Elbel, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at New York University. Brian, thanks.
Thank you.
The Detroit Auto Show starts on Monday. Organizers are expecting more manufacturers will show up this year following 2 years of lackluster attendance. Elisa Roth covers the auto industry for Marketplace, and she says the early buzz is about a couple of new vehicles.
The hottest cars at the show won't be crazy futuristic or luxurious top of the line. Michelle Krebs is an analyst at Edmunds.com. She says in the current economy, fanciful concept cars have gone the way of the Model T.
We are seeing a much more down-to-earth approach, introducing cars that people really will buy.
Favorites in Detroit this year will be a new sedan from VW, a mini minivan from Ford, and a revamped Honda Civic. The focus on the practical will extend to new technology, too. Michael Robinette is an analyst at IHS Automotive. He says that means technology we can use now or very soon.
Bringing electrification down to the common vehicle in some respects, reducing the price, really looking at more simpler systems that can save fuel and reduce emissions.
It wouldn't be an auto show without some glitz. Porsche, which skipped the last few years, will be back, ready to debut a new supercar. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
To Las Vegas now, where the high-tech world is gathered for the Consumer Electronics Show, the CES as it's called. So far, it's been all about tablet computers.
Well, today, Steve, techies are expecting some new devices that will use Verizon's 4G network. That's now the fastest data network in the country. Marketplace's Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Steve Henn is at the CES, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what's going on there at CES this year, Steve. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, there are lots of gadgets, which we can talk about in a second, but I'm also seeing that there's a bit of cautious optimism here about the consumer economy. Hmm. There are more exhibitors this year. They're using a lot more floor space than they did last year. The booths are taller. You know, I talked to Paul Lynch, who's at Expo Networks, and he's cautiously optimistic, and there are lots of guys like this.
Well, one of the things was the economy was a little better, and we have newer products. And this particular product's actually making money. So we wanted to show it to more people, and this is a great place to show it to a lot of people fast.
So Expo Networks makes voice over IP phones that they sell to small businesses. They saw business pick up about 8 months ago and then decided to spend the money to come to the show.
All right, well, tell us about the gadgets, Steve. That's what everybody wants to hear about. What are you seeing this year?
Everyone's talked about the tablets and the 3D television sets, and honestly, I haven't been blown away. The stuff I really have liked have been sort of the little things around the edges. There's a baby monitor here that taps directly into your iPhone, and it doesn't just measure the sound in the room. It takes pictures of your baby. It can sense the temperature, and then you can coo to your baby over your phone.
Just what we need.
Right. And, you know, for the older crowd, there's some bifocals that just have one lens, but the prescription changes with the tilt of your head. So if you look down, it's for reading glasses. You look up, it's distance vision. So that trend of, like, little gadgets that you don't really think of as computers but are somehow wired, it's cool.
Marketplace's Steve Henn in Las Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show. Thanks so much.
Sure thing.
And finally, Jeremy, I came across this blog. I don't know if you saw this on Boing Boing. I try and go to Boing Boing every once in a while. And writer and producer Andrea James touts the benefits of doing away with the alarm clock. That if you go to bed at a reasonable hour, your body will wake you up just in time for school or for work, even for your morning airline flight. Ugh. No technological help necessary.
Sounds dangerous to me.
It does to me as well. And we thank Andrea for the suggestion. I'm sure this could work for a lot of people, and it probably does work for Andrea. But I don't know about you, Jeremy. I'd sleep a little better knowing that pilots and police officers, even the president, all have their alarms set.
I would say so, absolutely. You know, though, Steve, I will say, I mean, you and I both wake up pretty early for work. Sometimes I will get up like 2 minutes before my alarm clock goes off.
And sometimes.
I'm just like, what is going on?
How do I know that? Sometimes, though.
Sometimes I won't, exactly. Like this morning.
Sometimes it's a couple minutes after the alarm clock goes off.
Exactly.
I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York, where it's 3 hours later. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Have a good weekend.
American Public Media.